I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Wayne Gary. Wayne is a partner in Benefit Resources. Recently, the Supreme Court just upheld the law, President Obama's Health Care Reform Act, which included the individual mandate. Maybe you can share quickly exactly what the individual mandate means.
The individual mandate, one thing it didn't do, which some people think it did, is mandate coverage for everybody. So there's no government program or anything where somebody is suddenly covered by insurance. All it did was mandate that an individual has to buy insurance or pay a tax. And the tax depends on whether you're an individual or a family. In 2014, the tax $95 or 1% of income. 2015, $325 or 2% of income. And 2016, $695 or 2.5% of income.
So let me stop you right there, because you mentioned in the first year it's $95, and you're calling this a tax. Some folks call it a penalty.
Well, I call it a tax because the Supreme Court said it was a tax.
It was a tax. $95 just doesn't seem like an issue in terms of, it's not going to force a lot of people to go out and buy insurance because they're fearful of paying that extra tax.
When they go to find out what it's going to cost, even a young person is going to be $150 a month or something like that, and they're going to say, I'm just going to go ahead and pay the tax.
So the Supreme Court's made its decision. The law stands in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Is this discussion over, or could things still change?
Things could change, because what the Supreme Court did in terms of the decision is there were two pieces that they were looking at. One was under the Commerce Clause, and one was the tax. Actually, a majority of the Supreme Court ruled that it was not constitutional under the Commerce Clause. There are some things that are mandated. For example, car insurance, that's mandated, but that's a privilege to drive. You don't have to drive. There's never been a situation where the government has said that you have to buy something simply because you exist. So Judge Roberts actually sided with the four conservative, what they call the four conservative judges, and said that I would agree that I cannot uphold this law based on the Commerce Clause. However, since it's a tax, and depending on which side you were on, one day they argued that it was a tax. The next day they argued it to what isn't a tax. What Roberts finally came to the conclusion was, yes, it's a tax. Therefore, I'm going to uphold the individual mandate because it's a tax. But we're like in the bottom of the fifth inning. And depending on what happens in November, that's going to depend on what happens to healthcare law. So depending on which side you're on, you're either ahead or behind. It's the bottom of the fifth. It's halfway finished. So basically what happens if the Democrats win, the White House and Congress, nothing's going to change. IRS, the Health and Human Services, and the Department of Labor are going to go ahead and start finalizing the regulations. If the Republicans sweep Senate, House, and the President, then there'll be some moves on the Republican to go ahead and make the law over. And that can happen because it was ruled a tax. Congress can overturn it with, Senate can overturn it with 51 votes instead of the 60 it would be required for the filibuster.
Well, let's talk about another piece of this, which I also think is very confusing, and it's the whole discussion about the exchanges. What's that mean? Who will be participating in these state exchanges?
Exchanges are going to be set up by the states, but a state does not have to set up an exchange. If they don't set up an exchange, it's going to be run by the federal government. It's going to be a situation where each individual in small group markets, it'll be a new venue. People will be able to comparison shop for standardized health packages. It facilitates enrollment. It administers tax credits so that people of all incomes will be able to obtain coverage.
But what's it really mean?
Employer could decide not to offer coverage. There is a mandate that if you're over 50 employees that you have to offer coverage, or again, there's going to be, in that case, a penalty. That was not called a tax, so I'll call it a penalty. But in the individual market, the group market under 50, there is no mandate that the employer has to buy the coverage. If they decide not to, the individuals can then buy it through the exchange. There's minimum plans available. They're going to probably be called bronze, gold, and platinum. There'll be minimum benefits that have to be purchased, and you'll have some help because there'll be some comparisons.
And very quickly, when does all this come into play?
That piece comes in 2014.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Wayne Gary. Wayne is a partner in Benefit Resources, and Wayne, I know that you're also an expert in this whole discussion on the health care reform. I hear all the time the question, what is the health care reform? How is it really going to impact my business? What should I be doing now? What are you advising your clients?
Well, in the beginning, when it was first passed, we knew that there were going to be court challenges. So we were basically, there were some things that were going to go into effect 2010, 2011. Those were obviously the more popular items of the healthcare reform, 2012 being an election year. Some of those things were all the positive things, things like no annual limits, no maximum limits overall, like $1 million, that's now unlimited and so forth. No pre-existing condition on children under 19 and under.
And letting older children stay on healthcare plans?
Older children staying on health plan, provided that the plan was non-grandfathered, and that's a confusing issue. So there's some things where I've had calls where people say, well, my employer has this, and I thought that was required, but if you're grandfathered, it isn't. Letting kids stay on if they're up to 26 is one of them. If you're grandfathered, you don't have to do that if the adult child is eligible for a plan where they are employed. That wouldn't have to be done for a non-grandfathered plan. Basically, we were holding tight until the Supreme Court ruled. When they did, unfortunately, there's another event in about 3.5 months called an election, which could also change things.
You just don't have any certainty.
There isn't.
But let's just assume for a moment that health care stays in place. That's the law right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what should a company do who has more than 50 employees?
Yeah, that's going to be up to each individual company depending on why they do insurance in the first place. We have a lot of clients have said all along, I would never do this except I've got to compete with other employers for employees. So in that case, that becomes something they're doing to attract employees. And then depending on the plan, they set their benefits. We do a lot of what's called benchmarking, where we can tell employers, if you're 55 people in a plumbing business, I can tell you what other companies, not only in Cincinnati, but regionally, that have 55 employees that are plumbing companies, what they provide. So we can give them an idea of how they're competing. We can tell them how much they're contributing compared to other companies. For example, if they contribute 50%, we might be able to tell them in your industry and your size, most companies are contributing 75%.
Okay. You know, you mentioned earlier that the magic threshold in terms of the number of employees to be subject to these new rules is 50. Do you think that's going to really cause a lot of companies to squash hiring?
Well, not squash hiring, but we think under 50, the estimate actually by, it was either done by the Chamber of Commerce or SBA, Small Business Administration Association, estimated that a third of companies under 50 would get rid of the group plan and let individuals simply go buy it through the exchanges. If they're less than 50, there's no mandate that requires an employer to buy group plan. I think one thing we need to talk about was the minimum loss ratio. There's some confusion there too, because employers right now, between now and August 1st, will be getting letters telling them whether or not they're going to get a rebate. And the rebate, briefly, is if you're a small group, and small group defined as under 50, 50 and under, you have to have a threshold of 80% loss ratio that the insurance company has. That means that if you give them a dollar, they have to return 80 cents.
And why would
in
they
claims.
Do that?
That happens whether they wanted to or not.
Okay.
But sometimes you give them a dollar and they pay $1.50 in claims. Sometimes you give them a dollar and they pay 50 in claims. But you're in a big pool, so that works out for everybody. Mm-hmm. In large group, it's 85%. So if they didn't make that ratio in a particular state, in a particular product, then companies could get a rebate. The rebate can be used for the employer to reduce his contribution. It can be used to defray administration costs, or it could be used for the employee in the form of a premium holiday for a month or lower premium rates. If they give the money back to the employee, the IRS has already ruled that that'll be taxed.
What's your telephone number?
Number is 513-232-9992.
I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Candace McGraw. Candace is the Chief Executive Officer of the Kenton County Airport Board, which we all know and love as the Greater Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport. Maybe you can talk about how DHL and other economic development activities are impacting our region.
Yeah, DHL is a tremendous news story for this region. Last year, they completed a $26 million expansion. They're in the midst of a $47 million expansion now and looking to do even more things in the future.
How many jobs is that?
DHL now has about 2,000 on-airport jobs every day, which is, you know, tremendous. CVG is now one of their three global super hubs in this world. We have Cincinnati. We have Leipzig, Germany, which handles Europe, and then we have Hong Kong. 92% of all the packages that DHL carries on the Americas comes through CVG. Hmm. And so we'd like to help them grow and expand as much as possible into the future.
You've attracted lots of businesses either because of the airport or actually in proximity to the airport because I assume partly because of DHL and and other means of getting freight in and out quickly.
CVG is really well situated in terms of access to a lot of places in the globe. And that's why, you know, you have UPS here, near here, you have FedEx near here, and DHL, fortunately, at CVG. All the aircraft in and out, they handle about 40% of the volume. It's an ideal setup, actually, because they're busy all night, mm-hmm. and then our passenger carriers are busy all day, so it makes really good use of our infrastructure.
What's your thoughts on regional transportation?
I am an active participant in OKI, and I know it's a great conversation about how you tie in all modes of transportation. And we have that communication and that conversation a lot. You know, I work with my transportation counterparts, and we have that conversation on how we can tie in, because it is so vital for the economic development of the region.
You think we'll ever have a mass transit option from the airport towards downtown Cincinnati?
I would hope so. I would love to see that tie-in. The master plan that was adopted by the airport in 2005 had a area reserved for a rail or some sort of spur into CVG, and we're continuing to preserve that into the future. It won't be anytime soon based on funding issues and other priorities, but I'd like to plan for that and make sure we have that eventuality into the future. It would be a great tie-in from downtown.
Let's talk about some of your priorities for the next year. What is your top two or three?
Priorities, of course, air service and how we grow and develop that. We're going to place a lot of emphasis on growing our non-aeronautical revenue, diversifying our revenue stream. So if we can grow our concession revenue, grow our parking revenue, develop our land, that'll just make the cost of operating at CVG for the airlines even less than what it is today.
Maybe you can explain that when you say the cost of operations.
Each of the airlines pays what's called a landing fee, and they also pay terminal rentals. I have to say our landing fee and our terminal rentals are at or below every other airport in our region, just to be clear about that. Oftentimes people talk, say, about the high airfares out of CVG. I think you can certainly find deals out of CVG, but the airfares that are charged and the fares that the airport charges the carriers are not related. Overall, an airline's cost to operate at an airport is less than 4% of its overall cost. So we're very mindful. We run a very lean operation. We run our business like a business because we know what impacts everybody else in the community.
If people would like information about the airport, what's your website?
They're welcome to go to our website, cvgairport.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Candace McGraw. Candace is the Chief Executive Officer of the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport. And Candace, I know that the airport serves a big role for business, you know, for helping people, businesses get from one place to another. But what role does business have to play on the other side with the airport in terms of helping to support the airport?
Over the last year in my role as CEO, I've really tried to reach out and talk with a lot of businesses in town, wanting to know where they need to be, where they want to fly over the next few years, where do they see their areas of business growth. I also want to have the conversation or try to have the conversation with them about where they need to be 5 or 10 years from now. We know there's a concentration of businesses here that are European tied. But what is the next economy? Is it South America? Is it Latin America? Is it Asia? And do we need to develop relationships with those carriers now, trying to situate the economic development strategy for the region for 5 to 10, 15 years out? Because those relationships take a long time to build. So I talk a lot with the folks at the Chamber about that, where they're seeing the need or hearing the need from their members as well.
We are one of 3 world hubs for DHL.
Correct.
What other economic development opportunities do you see coming down the road?
Yeah, we're very blessed that we have about 7,000 acres on the campus of CVG. There are many of those acres, maybe about 100, 150, 200 acres that could be ripe for development. So right now we're in the midst of a master plan that lays out notionally what sorts of things should go where they need to be around the airport campus. One, of course, is focusing around DHL and preserving enough land for them to grow, but at the same time reserving parcels for those companies that need to be at or near a logistics hub like that. They call that end of runway development. And we're fortunate to have a great campus to do that. At the same time, we have certain parcels that we're looking at, maybe say for commercial development or office park development. So we know that's a long-term strategy, you know, given the economy and the way it grows more slowly now.
that type of activity, that kind of revenue growth, does that help drive airfare down?
It won't drive airfare down. What if we can generate revenues from non-aeronautical sources, you know, sources other than the airlines, what that does is ultimately lower the airline cost to operate at the airport. Now, whether they translate that into a fee reduction, a fare reduction, that's up to the individual airline. But we try to run our airport as lean as possible. We run it as a very efficient business.
I assume that does make it more attractive in getting new airlines to come in. At least that's one of the factors, obviously not the
sure.
only one.
But my question is, mm-hmm. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but if that's the case, then why is it that we continually seem to have some of the highest fares?
I think as we bring in more carriers, as we diversify our carrier base, as our existing carriers, say our non-Delta carriers, expand a little more, I think you will see some price diversity. I think once you have some carrier diversity, get price stability.
What else do you think that people would want to know, should know about the airport? What would do you think people would find most surprising?
This year, we were recently named the best regional airport in North America for the second year in a row by Skytrax, which is an independent, internationally based organization that ranks airports. So we were very honored to receive that award.
Is that like based on service?
It's based on customer service. It's based on some other criteria. Again, all independently tabulated and done. So to be named the best regional airport in North America 2 years in a row is great. One of the other things, if safety and security, we know that's the underpinning of the airport, and we place a great deal of emphasis on that. We are the only airport in the country that has what's called Safety Act designation. It's a designation awarded by the Department of Homeland Security saying that we meet or exceed every standard for safety and security. And then the other great thing going on is we were named the safest airport in America by Travel and Leisure magazine for 2011, and that was based on a review of certain statistics.
Well, that's wonderful.
News. Lots of good
congratulations.
Stuff.
If people would like more information about the airport, your website is
cvgairport.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Mary Hurlburt. Mary is the Community Outreach Coordinator for Lifespan Credit Counseling Services. And Mary, one of the things that I think we hear a lot about these days is this whole discussion about identity theft. And it's happening to our children.
6 months ago, if somebody had said, what can I do to protect my child's identity? How can I find out if it's been stolen? There was almost no way to find out, because if a parent tried in the past to get a child's credit report to see if it was stolen, well, they're not supposed to have one. As soon as you put in the birth date, they'd say there's no credit report available. But the Federal Trade Commission came out with press release the end of May. And if anyone goes to their website, ftc.gov/ID theft, and select Safeguarding Your Child's Future, they tell you how to pull a credit report from each of the three credit bureaus. You're going to have to prove that you're the parent. But if you have any inkling that your child might be the victim of identity theft, if there's somebody in your family, and honestly, many, many times these are family members, if there's somebody in your family that you think is just a little bit shady, check your child's identity. They have the forms in there. They have all the phone numbers in there. Anything a parent would need to make sure that their child's identity is safe. For the most part, children don't find out their identity has been stolen until they turn 18 and try to buy a car, move into an apartment, pick up that first credit card, and they're told they can't.
And all of a sudden, they have this horrible credit record, which they had absolutely no part in creating.
No part in creating, including times that we see a three-year-old filed bankruptcy.
But how do you prevent it from happening in the first place?
For children and adults, it's a matter of, as much as possible, keep your records private. I've met people that say even if they're paying their bills and their teenage children walk in with friends, that they gather everything up and move them. Keep your personal information out of the way.
Well, and that's a hard thing to do these days with so many young children, even today, on Facebook. There's so much information about them out there, their address, their phone numbers even, email
addresses.
Even
our Facebook is as has just ruined it. Even your identification questions. What high school did you go to? Well, if you have a Facebook account, the whole world knows what high school you went to. They may not put your Social Security there, but since we're trying to protect our Social Security numbers, a lot of times they're just pulling credit reports with addresses. And then they may ask one little security question. What high school did you go to? Well, shoot, it matches. Okay, fine. You will find a lot of people in the IT world, one of my sons included, no Facebook page, no LinkedIn page. Absolutely not, Mom. I'm not going to do it because he knows the danger.
Well, and if you're a thief and you want to steal someone's identity, I would think a child is the perfect person because it's oftentimes not going to be noted for years.
The deceased and the very young. Very, very vulnerable.
For parents who are listening, I think they just need to get active. They need to go online, make sure their kids, if they are letting them use Facebook or other social media, make sure they're not putting that information out there.
It's up to parents to protect the children.
Well, Mary, thank you for bringing this to our attention and for the other great information that you're always so willing to share. And if folks would like more information, your website is
www.lifespanohio.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Ellie Moffitt. Ellie is a vice president and principal at Ball & Gaynor, and I understand that Ball & Gaynor has grown substantially. And at the end of 2011, what, you're about $6.5 billion under management?
Mid-year 2012,
oh,
yes.
Okay.
Well, that's up from $2.5 billion at the end of 2009, so that's quite a jump. Our high-quality dividend approach to investing has really been working well, and we've been blessed with tremendous asset growth. Our approach to investing has resonated well with our clients, with their friends, and their advisors.
What is the approach that seems to be working so well?
Well, we've been around about 22 years now, so we're getting a little older, but our primary business is to work with wealthy individuals that have about $750,000 or more, and we work with them very closely to help them achieve their goals and build a portfolio with a suitable amount of risk. People typically come to us when they retire or when they're selling a company or if they're fortunate enough to inherit money or else they're proactively taking the initiative to move from their existing advisor and come to us or hire an advisor. And that's what we like to do best is work individually with people and custom tailor a program. In addition, we work with well-to-do people who have very good accounting advice, different legal advice, and we hear lots of good ideas and we're able to share them with our clients and suggest they go back to their accountant or attorney and perhaps these ideas will work with them.
Well, you've done something pretty new for Ball & Gaynor. You've made your first entry into the mutual fund management business, and that's got to be exciting for you.
It is. In the past, we've, as I said, worked very closely with our high net worth individuals, and we haven't had an easy way to help individuals who haven't yet been lucky enough to amass $750,000 or more. So this mutual fund does give us a way to serve their needs.
Your separate strategies over the last few years have been achieving about a 5% return compared to the S&P 500 that has only achieved about a 0.2%. What is your investment strategy that's allowed you to see that kind of performance gains?
We have a high-quality dividend growth approach to investing, and the benefits that this approach has historically offered are a growing stream of income, which is a wonderful thing for an individual, an endowment, or a foundation, or anyone with a spending rule to have. And for investors without a spending rule, it's fabulous to have a good stream of income when times are tough because they can reinvest those dividends into stocks when they're on sale. The other benefit that our dividend growth approach provides is much greater downside protection. Historically, if you look at the numbers, our style has held up much better in storms. And that's a wonderful thing because that's when people get most nervous and it gives them confidence to hold their position during difficult times. And finally, we are off the charts to the good in terms of risk. Our risk in our business at standard deviation or volatility is much, much lower. And part of it is because we've bought these high quality dividend paying names that that way.
Ellie, thanks for that great information. If folks would like to find more information about Ball & Gaynor, what's your website?
www.ball-gaynor.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Ellie Moffitt. Ellie is a vice president and principal at Ball & Gainer. And Ellie, over the last several years, Ball & Gainer has been able to achieve about a 5% per year income growth strategy. How are you able to get that kind of performance for your clients?
Our approach has worked well because it's resonated with clients, their friends, and advisors. We've had excellent word of mouth and distribution.
And what is that approach?
Our high-quality growth approach to investing focuses on companies with better-than-average sales, earnings, growth, very good dividend growth.
You mentioned dividends. Maybe you can explain that a little further.
We think dividends are a wonderful indicator of what's going on in a company. We often say that earnings are opinion, but dividends are fact. Who has a better view of what's going on a company than a board of directors? So when they signal an increase in the dividend, they're looking over the horizon and seeing more than any of the analysts can see. And so we look at increases that they might provide as a wonderful indicator of what's going on in a company.
Assuming that laws stay the same, which means that dividends going forward, once the Bush tax cuts expire, will now be taxed at ordinary income rates, 39%, potentially 43%, if the Medicare surtax of 3.8% kicks in. Do you think that's going to change the way companies or investors look at dividends at the higher tax rates?
Well, there are a couple things to keep in mind here. Half the market, about 50% of the market, is in IRAs or pension funds, so they don't really care about taxes. 8% of the market is foreign money, so they're not really affected by our tax rules. So the remaining 42%, they may be affected a bit. However, where are they going to go? Right now, with cash paying zero and a 10-year treasury paying 1.5%, they're still better to have a slightly or significantly higher tax on their dividends, but the dividends are growing in the companies that we buy. In over 10 years, if they're growing at 7%, the dividend can double.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still think that's the best deal out there.
Ellie, recently Ball & Gainer stepped into the mutual fund management business. Maybe you can talk about how that can also benefit your clients.
Sure. Historically, we've worked with individuals with $750,000 or more, and we really like to sit down and get to know a person very well and what their goals and objectives are and custom tailor that portfolio. But for people that haven't achieved that level of wealth, this is a way that we will be able to take care of their investment needs with our dividend growth approach to investing.
So effectively, you're taking your strategy that you've been implementing that's certainly been very successful to your clients over the last 20 plus years, and now you'll be able to bring that same strategy to mutual fund investors who have less net worth.
There's been tremendous demand for our dividend growth approach to investing. A mutual fund company saw the need to provide that to their clients, and they asked, would we help them? Would we provide the investment advice? And, you know, we're, of course, delighted.
That's got to be a great testament to your strategy. Where do you see the market, Ellie, over the next several months, the next year or so?
Well, I would have to admit our crystal ball is as cloudy as anyone else's. But in a low return world, having a greater percentage of the return from your portfolio in dividends is like having a bird in hand. We think in this environment, it'll bring a lot more stability to a portfolio and a lot more predictability. So we think we're going to do better than ever in this sort of uncertain environment.
Well, Ellie, congratulations on your success. And if folks would like more information about Ball & Gainer, what's your website?
www.ball-gainer.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Scott Devaney. Scott is an audit partner with the Cincinnati office of Grant Thornton. And an issue that I think has just become such a big deal for so many businesses is this problem with cybersecurity. Maybe you can talk about what you're saying.
No doubt. It is a huge issue. And I guess maybe to help ground people a little bit, why don't we cover what exactly cybersecurity is? Cybersecurity includes protection of information and property from theft, corruption, or natural disaster, while allowing the information and property to remain accessible, productive to its intended users. Now, I think it's important.
So in English, what's that mean?
Here's what I'm going to tell you. What's important is you have a level of security because there's certain information assets that need to be available to the users of the organization in order to function. The question is how restrictive do you make that? Do you lock it down where you can't do your business, or do you leave it wide open where everybody and their cousin could come in and get it?
But in your experience, do a lot of companies have problems with their security? It's not as secure as they think it is?
Absolutely. Let me share a few items with you. So you think, you know, these large organizations out there have the best security out there and they're locked down tight. Couple examples, and probably a lot of people have already identified these before, but TJX Companies, which is the parent of TJ Maxx and Home Goods, in 2007, its computer system was hacked and personal information of approximately 46 million customers was compromised over the span of nearly 2 years. Also, one of the largest data thefts of all time occurred at Heartland Payment Systems, a credit card processing company. Three men were eventually indicted for stealing more than 130 million credit card numbers from Heartland and other companies.
And you think if that can happen to large organizations, smaller organizations have to be very susceptible as well.
And, you know, quite honestly, every single organization has information assets that have to be protected.
Typically, you're going to have all types of financial information, credit information, confidential information about, for sure, your employees, in most cases, customers as well.
You know, and again, it's the information is all over. And also, you got to keep in mind, too, that there are regulations that are going to require the certain maintaining and maintenance of that information. So, for instance, protected health information. You have to operate in certain parameters to keep that information protected, let alone your trade secrets, let alone your social security numbers of all your employees, to get all that stuff locked down but usable to the organization and some of the outsiders.
Well, that's a real balancing act then too, isn't it?
Because total balancing act.
So many people want to be able to have access, work from home, work remotely. How many times do you walk into a coffee work establishment, see people with their laptops, their iPads, probably logged in to companies' computers? How do you balance that?
It's tough because, you know, also, you know, looking at the table over here, Chris, there's your iPhone. How often do you look at email and access data on your iPhone?
Too many times a day.
So you've got that access, again, mobile operating system. There are vulnerabilities. And again, you've got to balance it. You cannot lock down your employees and your users so that they can't access any of the information. You've got to give them mobile access because that's the way we operate.
So it would be really smart for me to have a password on my iPhone, but what a hassle to log that in every time I turn it on, which happens to be a few hundred times a day. Exactly.
You know, what you will find in some larger organizations or even smaller organizations, you will have to be required to use a password on your iPhone because if not, you can't use it. The organization will lock you down.
What's your website if people would like information at Grant Thornton?
It's www.grantthornton.com.
Thank you for being my guest, and thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Today, our guest is Scott DeVinny. Scott is an audit partner in Grant Thornton, and Scott's here to talk a little bit about cybersecurity. I assume the first thing an organization should do is really assess what level of security they have with their systems now. Is that a security risk assessment? Is that what you call that type of study?
Absolutely. Before you start the process, you don't even know what you have or what you don't know what you don't have. So management should perform a security risk assessment to evaluate the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information assets throughout the organization.
Well, what that really means is for business owners, management, key management people, really taking ownership and really taking steps to make sure their company's secure, because there's a big liability potentially if someone can hack into your system.
Absolutely, and it all starts at the tone at the top, right? No matter the size of your organization, if you have a small, closely held organization, the owner is going to have critical business assets that need to be protected. If you've got a larger organization, say a public company, the audit committee is going to be responsible for governance over that security risk assessment. And so no matter what size of the organization you have, some level of risk assessment has to be performed.
And when you do a risk assessment, I assume you look at what vital information that the company has that needs to be kept confidential, and then where it's stored and maybe where it should be stored and who has access.
It's taking an inventory. So that inventory is all businesses are going to have employees. So right off the bat, you know you have social security numbers and personnel information that needs to be secured. You know, you kind of go down if you've got customer lists, you need to keep those secured. You know, God forbid if you have credit card numbers on customers. If you're a retail establishment, you've got to keep those secure.
In the cybersecurity area, just because you think as a management leader or owner of a company that you have certain processes in place, you really don't know until you go in and lift under the hood, correct?
Correct. And sometimes what you end up by seeing, too, is actually organizations thinking that they've got it under control. Nothing's happened to us. We're fine. We've got great systems in place. Everything's locked down. However, you know, it's often helpful to hire an outside consultant, outside firm, to say, listen, can you do a security risk assessment for me, a vulnerability test? Let's look at the vulnerabilities outside the organizations, doing simple internet searches, Google searches, to see if I can find IP addresses of your company or web addresses, you know, anything that I can do to penetrate the system. You also need to look inside. You know, you have to look at the vulnerabilities within the organization. What kind of information do the employees have? Is there information that they have that they shouldn't have? And so you kind of have to look on both sides, the inside and out. You'd like to think that everybody in your organization is honest, but there's reasons why you've got to keep a locked-down system but still usable.
Well, and even if they're honest, they could be careless, which is just as bad.
You could even think of something as simple as a secured building where somebody may tailgate into the building, right? So somebody's going to, an employee opens the door and somebody's trying to get in behind them and comes right in. Again, those individuals may come into the organization and hook up into a computer or whatnot, and then again, do their damage inside because maybe that's easier.
If people want information to learn more about cybersecurity or how to reach you, what's the contact information?
Well, you can give me either a call at area code 513-345-4600, and you can also check us out online at www.grantthornton.com.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise, and we're continuing our discussion about financial resolutions or how you can make your business more financially fit in 2012. And you know, Crystal, one thing I think is always important to do is to look at your business plan, review it, and revise it as you need to so that you can use it as a tool going forward.
People think of a business plan as something that you only need when you're starting a new division or if you need to get a bank loan, but really a business plan is something that's integral to your company's success. It includes strategies that will produce tangible results. It identifies goals that you must attain to be able to really move your business forward. And then certainly it should include who else on your team is going to help achieve those goals.
And as you make decisions throughout the year, you have to think about, now, how does this tie into my business plan? Does it follow the business plan? Does it make sense?
And you know, a lot of people think you just need goals at the company level, Tom, but I think the only way to really execute on an overall business strategy is to determine how you can push those goals down to the departmental levels and then even further down to individual employees so that everyone in the group, in the company, is aligned and moving in the same direction to get the business to where you want it to be. And certainly along the way, make sure you measure and monitor those results to keep people on track.
And speaking of measuring and monitoring results, I think one thing that's important for you to do periodically, not necessarily every year, is determine what your company is worth. You know, actually get a valuation. Figure out if it's worth what you think it is. And if it's not, you should figure out what the drivers are that are causing you not to be as valuable a company as you think it should be.
Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, many business owners take so much pride in their business. To them, it's worth in their minds a lot more than it might be to an outside third party. So having an objective, independent valuation certainly can help you determine where you need to tweak certain things in your business to bring more value.
And I think it's particularly important if you want to sell your business, not next year, but if you want to sell it in the next few years, it's a good idea to get a pulse of the value so you can see where you need to go with the company in order to get the value you really need in order to retire.
Tom and I are certified forensic financial analysts, which means that we go out and we help organizations and companies look at their controls, their processes to, one, hopefully help them be more efficient, but also to look for weaknesses in internal controls to minimize the opportunity for fraud. Because the last thing you want to do is work really hard, only to have all your hard work benefit the wrong people.
Well, and you can hardly pick up a newspaper without finding someone who's being prosecuted for fraud. But in almost all cases, those people aren't paying back the company that they defrauded. So it's much cheaper if you can put some processes in place up front and prevent fraud rather than recover from the fraud after it's happened.
Tom and I are CPAs, and we like to measure things and account for things. But measuring things absolutely gets things done. What gets gets measured, gets done. So be sure that your financial projections, your sales forecasts are current and they're realistic, and they're on track to monitor what you need to get the results that is critical for your company's success.
And finally, I think you need to engage your employees and encourage them to participate in your business plan. What key factors there are, share with them the key factors that drive the business so that they can help drive those factors as well.
Those folks are right there with your customers. Often their ideas, their solutions can be very powerful and helpful to your organization. So ask what else needs to be done to make the company more successful. And certainly offering employee incentives for reaching goals is rewarding. It lets them know you value them and it makes work fun. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your trusted business advocates.